Welcome back to this Tuesday's Across the Movie Aisle, presented by Bulwark Plus. I'm your host, Sonny Bunch, culture editor of The Bulwark, and I'm joined, as always, by the award-winning Alyssa Rosenberg of The Washington Post and Peter Suderman of Reason Magazine. Alyssa, Peter, how are you today?
Swell.
I am happy to be talking about movies with friends.
First up in controversies and non-controversies is a bombshell profile of Augusta Britt in the latest issue of Vanity Fair. Now, who is Augusta Britt? Well, one way to put it is that she is Cormac McCarthy's muse, a secret love interest whose life inspired books by the man considered by many to be the greatest American novelist of the last 50 or 60 years. Indeed, this is how author Vincenzo Barney puts it in the opening paragraph of his story, quote, "I'm about to tell you the craziest love story in literary history, and before you ransack the canon for a glamorous rebuttal, I must warn you, its preeminence is conclusive." End quote. Another way to put it is that Britt, who met McCarthy when she was 16 and in and out of foster care, and he was 42 and a failed novelist living on the edge of poverty and alcoholic ruination, is a victim of grooming, of predation, a child who was functionally kidnapped by McCarthy and taken to Mexico, where they consummated their relationship a year or so later. And indeed, Britt herself says that she and McCarthy worried about this interpretation of their life, which is first raised about six pages into the print edition of the feature. And it comes up like this, quote, "He was 43, she was 17. The image is startling, possibly illegal. At the very least, it raises questions about inappropriate power dynamics and the specter of premeditated grooming, but not to Britt, who had suffered unspeakable violence at the hands of many men in her young life, then or now." End quote. And the reaction to Barney's piece was one of almost universal scorn, at least on social media. There was the question of framing this as a love story rather than a story of predation. Though I think that decision has as much to do with Britt as Barney here. There was much fun had at the expense over the overwritten quality of some of the prose, right? Which features lines like, quote, "There's the muse for you, full of equine wisdom, horse sense." It's a real line from the piece, end quote. Here's just one more, quote, "We're up early enough to watch the sun unbraid the first permissive stars," end quote. Again, it's an image that doesn't even really work. It's very flowery, put it that way. Look, the thing is overwritten for sure. Understandably so, some people are making fun of this. But one controversial opinion I have is that this writing annoys people depending, more or less, depending on how they read the story, right? So I skimmed it online when it was first released, like everybody else, and I thought it was a little bit silly for some of the reasons everyone else did, right? But then I got my hands on a hard copy because I'm a man of wealth and taste. I have a subscription to Vanity Fair that comes to my house every month. And it still feels a little overwritten.
Is it because you got the media comp rate?
No, I pay, I don't know what I pay. I think it's like $12 a year or something. Probably the media comp rate, frankly. But I got it, and I actually I sat down and read the whole thing in magazine form, you know, kind of as it's meant to be written, theoretically. And it still feels a little overwritten, but it feels acceptably overwritten, as one might expect in a journal of ideas, right? You know, the lines, if you read them on a web page, they just scream Tumblr. It's like, here's a live journal. I got you a live journal here. That's what you're reading. In hard copy, they scream Vanity Fair, maybe Esquire or Vogue, probably not New Yorker or The Atlantic. But the point is, they feel like magazine sentences, even if they're a little bit silly. And I guess the big question is, all right, so, okay, McCarthy had a relationship with a teenage girl that skirted the law at best, was possibly statutory rape. Does that change? What does it change? That's the question here. What does it change? And I guess it kind of depends on what we're talking about, right? Like, I think regardless of the legality of the situation, it's a valuable guide to understanding his work. And I find it hard to believe that anybody who has read McCarthy would be shocked by learning some of the stuff in this. I mean, the novel Sutri is always supposed to be sort of a kind of self-autobiographical novel, and there's a lot of fairly nasty stuff in that. And the 1970s, novelist, passed as a foreign country, et cetera, et cetera. McCarthy's dead now, right? So if you're buying books, you're not, it's not like you're benefiting him. He's gone. It's not like it matters on that count. And Britt's own recounting of their relationship, I think, bears a lot of weight here. Her description of what she felt and how she experienced it. The most interesting thing in the profile comes from her description of her reaction to his mining her life for material in his novels and in his screenplays. And it's only here, interestingly, that she uses words like violation, right? So, quote, this is one thing she says. This is her words, not the author's. Quote, I was surprised it didn't feel romantic to be written about. I felt kind of violated. All these painful experiences regurgitated and rearranged into fiction, end quote. And Barney says the experience would send her into a depression, and that sounds pretty bad. One might even suggest transference of a sort, a belated reaction to the very existence of their relationship, which began, again, when she was 16 years old. Like, it's not ideal, folks. Alyssa, how should people respond to this story? Both as a piece of writing, you know, that's a separate question, and as a way to understand McCarthy, and as a way to understand our own relationship to art, our own experience of taking art in, of understanding, interpreting art.
That's a lot of questions.
There's a lot going on here. I feel like this is it's a very interesting subject.
Yeah.
Even if it's kind of terrible.
The author of this profile did this interview with Dan Coyce at Slate that is kind of bracingly insane. And there's this fascinating line in it. He says, Augusta, in his response to Dan Coyce's questions, he said, Augusta had long thought of telling her story. Indeed, she says McCarthy actively encouraged her for decades. But it wasn't until she read my horrible dreck on Substack that she felt it could be pulled off. That is, told from her perspective, with my daringly bad style absorbing most of the controversy and opinion columns. Which I think is kind of fascinating, right? I mean, and maybe it's just, you know, this guy trying to spin the reaction into something sort of purposeful. But if that was true, if Augusta was like, this guy's insane and he is going to sort of absorb the first wave, I don't know. I mean, that's almost, it's so fascinatingly literary as a suggestion that it almost feels like a novelistic choice, right? It's, I mean, what an idea to choose the person you tell your literary bombshell story to because of how you think people will react to his prose in this sort of like sidelong way. I have no idea what to make of that. And of course, that's him saying it, not Britt herself saying it. I don't know. I will confess to not really being a Cormac McCarthy person in general. I've read some of his stuff, but he is not a major touchstone for me. You know, I think there clearly is going to be an interesting debate here about the extent to which Britt understands herself to be the muse of these novels and sort of literary scholars' arguments about what McCarthy was actually thinking at any given point. I mean, I think my understanding is that McCarthy scholars kind of contest some of her contentions. And, you know, I don't know how you sort that out, right? I mean, is there a, you know, is there a trove of letters where McCarthy's like, I'm telling Augusta that she's the muse for all of this, but really it's something else, right? Like, I don't entirely know how you sort that out, but I do think that's going to be really interesting sort of literary history debate. And then, you know, and it's inevitably going to be entangled, you know, to a certain extent. Does Britt feel okay about this because it ended up producing great art? Is, you know, as the piece suggests, you know, this feeling of violation kind of displaced onto the act of being written about? You know, I don't think it, you know, I think this revelation will spur a lot of debate about McCarthy's work that will be sort of interesting as a matter of literary history and literary criticism. But that's sort of separate from the question of sort of how Britt makes meaning of her life and how she feels about this decision. And I also think it should be possible to say that Britt doesn't have to feel violated for this to have been wrong, right? I mean, you know, I think that entering into a relationship with someone who's 24 years younger than you is, you know, if that person is below the age of consent, is always going to be vexed in terms of the power dynamic. The fact that she had experienced sort of exceptional violence and was in the foster care system complicates that even further. You know, I think we can hold both of those ideas in our head at the same time, and we can give deference to Britt's understanding of her own experience while still saying that this is obviously wrong.
Yeah. This is one reason I've always been skeptical of the criminal justice system is set up to, work for society more than work for victims themselves, right? I mean, like, that's an awkward way of putting it, but because somebody does not feel that they have been wrong does not mean a wrong has not been committed. And it's always a tricky balance there. Peter, what did you make of this story? As an editor, what did you make of this story? Because this is the sort of feature piece that an editor, you know, gets and either kind of throws their hands up and just says, whatever, dude, go for it. Or, like, tries to sit down and really bang into a different shape. And I do not think that it was successfully banged into a different shape, necessarily.
Well, the main thing it made me think about was the crickets and the rust beetles scuttling among the nettles of the sage thicket, right? Vamanos, amigos, he whispered, and threw the busted leather flint craw over the loose weave of the saddlecock and rode on in the friskulating dust light. That's Eli Cash from the Royal Tenenbaums, one of my favorite little bits in the entire Wes Anderson oeuvre, and it is this pitch-perfect both satire of and homage to over the like McCarthy style gorgeous overwriting, which this piece is not McCarthy level, right? Like, it's not. At the same time, there's a way in which it is reflecting the kind of muscular, intense, idiosyncratic prose that McCarthy was known for, right? Like, you wouldn't have written the piece this way about, I don't know, Agatha Christie. Or John Grisham. Like, it wouldn't have made any sense. I think editors should probably be at magazines, especially these days. I think editors should probably actually be more willing to let this sort of thing go through and to give this sort of writing some breathing room and some space on the page. And the reason why, I think, is because there's a school of thought that argues these days that, like, readers don't really care about the writing. In fact, it's often kind of put off by good writing, and like, what you just really want as an editor is for everything to be kind of clean and ultra simple and clear. And there's some truth to that, sure, right? Like, a lot of editing is just designed to sort of bring up the level of prose, just make something that, like, to make stuff that kind of doesn't work good enough, right? That's what a lot of editors have to do, right? It's not actually about making things super excellent. It's making everything consistently good enough. But you'll never get something great if you don't try, and you're going to fail some of the time in trying. And I'm not saying this is great, but I think that, like, the subject matter made it reasonable, like, not made it non-crazy to go after the material in this way. And sometimes you, like, what are we in this for? Are we in this to, like, clean out all, just like, is our, is, did you get into journalism and into editing just to, like, clean up people's kind of messy sentences and make them like AP style and, like, Twitter friendly, you know, so that, like, there's absolutely no ambiguity in anything and you totally get everything that everybody say. Like, there's just a thesis statement makes it so you don't have to read the rest of the piece and a headline that gives you everything that's going to be in it. Sometimes that's what we got into it for, and in fact, sometimes that's even a good way to present information to people. Like, that's how you get stuff across, is with a kind of rigorous, consistent clarity. But sometimes you get into it because you love writing and you love people playing with writing and you love people playing with words. And we're going to talk about Gladiator 2 in a little while. And the script isn't very good. But there is an interesting parallel, I think, between this piece and the way that Denzel Washington treats the script in Gladiator 2. Because Even though the script is not all that good, Denzel Washington just takes these kind of trashy lines and he gives them the most delicious, the most delightful, the most self-delighted line readings, which may not even be good in some sort of classic sense, but they are. It is wonderful to see somebody actually trying to practice the craft rather than simply dutifully reading the lines and giving them this sort of low-key underplaying of things that a lot of screen actors are taught to do because you wouldn't want to go big. And just to watch him do that is so wonderful, even if it's not always a truly great, truly excellent performance. And there's a little bit of that here. And even if you just hate all of it, even if you think it's bad, writers should be trying this stuff, and editors should let them sometimes when it's appropriate. And in an absolutely bonkers, forever long Cormac McCarthy kind of big scoop narrative piece, it's appropriate. It's like the subject matter aligns with this kind of prose. And so that's what I think is, I don't know that I would have necessarily had the experimental that I would have wanted to myself let the piece go through in exactly this form. At the same time, I kind of admire an editor and a writer just saying like, what, you know what, we're going to go for it. And they did. And they got people to talk. They got people to talk about the prose itself, which almost never happens in writing these days.
Very, very true. It's a miracle in a way. The secondary question here would be the angle of the piece, right? Which is, I think 90% of the reason people got mad about this piece is that opening paragraph in which this relationship is described as a great literary love story. It's flip in a way that I think is not appropriate for the subject matter, which is, I think, a little more serious than like a jaunty, let me tell you the greatest. Do you understand what I'm saying? I just feel the tone is wrong in that opening paragraph. And I think that is what set off most of the criticism about the piece, frankly.
Yeah. Does that opening paragraph actually wrestle with the gravity of the rest of the piece? I think that's a good question. And that opening paragraph is the teaser, is the hook, right? It's almost like it's like the trailer for the rest of the piece. It's the marketing materials, right? It's the we remember the Jurassic Park advertisements from 1993, right? 1993 was when the first one came out. You know, it's an adventure 65 million years in the making. And that's like all the advertisements, all the print and TV material. That's this opening paragraph kind of works in the same way. I think I both agree with you. And if I did want to defend it, it would actually be to go back a little bit to what I was talking about earlier, this sort of editing for hypey, unambiguous clarity. Like this story is complex and long enough that in some ways any opening paragraph is going to struggle to capture all of it. That doesn't mean that this was the best they could have done or that this was appropriate. That's just not exactly a defense. At the same time, it's a difficult just kind of editorial construction problem to solve, which is that getting the tone right and capturing what the rest of the piece is going to be and what you're getting yourself into with a piece like this, and also selling it, which is what the opening of a piece like this has to do. It's just a very, very difficult exercise. I don't think they got it totally right, but it's a hard thing to do.
Alyssa, what do you? I felt like you were about to.
No, sometimes these things fall in people's laps, and you know, as sort of appears to have happened here. I mean, literally, the writer got the story because, like, she read a Substack and liked it. And sometimes that's just how
Substack is where it's happening, folks.
Substack. That's right.
I will say, look, this happens from time to time. Yeah. I will say things that I have written in the Washington Post, not Substack yet, but there were things I have written in the Washington Post and elsewhere where, like, the author or the screenwriter or somebody involved with a production reaches out and says, hey, thanks for actually understanding the thing I was trying to do. Which is, you know, it's like, that's not why I write, but like it is occasionally nice to hear. And I've, you know,
yeah,
made some connections and discussions with folks that way. It's very nice.
Yeah, I will say I have not ever run off to you know, another state and just like lived with a subject of my writing for like 9 months off of anything I've written in the post. But
Yes, well, no, that's not.
And that's, I mean, I feel like that's a whole other sort of interesting question about this piece is like, you know, sort of who's playing who, who's getting the, you know, the advantage here. It's just, it's interesting. I find it all kind of fascinating.
All right. So what do we think? Is it a controversy or a non-controversy that this piece exists? Alyssa?
I mean, it's a non-controversy. Like, it's a, that it exists is a non-controversy. But it's definitely kind of wild.
Peter.
It's not a controversy that it exists. It's a controversy, like what it describes is controversial.
Yes. Yeah, I think that's a good way to put it. It is a, it's certainly a controversial subject matter. I do think it's a little bit controversial in how it is framed and written. But I also agree with you, Peter. Like, I this the writer of this piece was just taking rivers of grief on social media and like fairly nasty mockery of the writing style. And like, all right, some of it is a little overwritten, fine. But like, again, do we want just boring cookie cutter prose everywhere? Do we want everybody hewing to all of the correct opinions and beliefs and styles? And I think you just need to write
a piece titled Why Cookie Cutter Prose is Bad for Journalism. In this essay, I will.
Yeah. 17 reasons why cookie cutter prose is bad for journalism.
You should do this as a TikTok.
Oh, God. Do it as a YouTube video. All right. That is, you know, that again, controversy kind of. We'll move on. Make sure to swing by for our bonus episode on Friday, on which we will reveal what we are thankful for this year. It's Thanksgiving. What are we thankful for this year? It's been an interesting year for a bunch of different reasons. We'll talk about what we're thankful for. Now on to the main event. Gladiator 2. Spoilers to come, as always. We've seen the movie. We're going to discuss what happens in the movie. It's impossible to understand what went wrong, and I guess right, in this movie if you don't understand some of the key plot points. So if you're worried about that sort of thing, log off now. Don't complain to me later. All right. All right, so Gladiator 2 picks up 16 years or so after the death of Marcus Aurelius Maximus, memorably played by Russell Crowe in the original, where he killed the Emperor Commodus in the arena in the hopes of bringing about the restoration of the Roman Republic. That didn't happen. Didn't happen. No Roman Republic. Rome is now ruled by the insane twin emperors Geta, played by Joseph Quinn, and Caracalla, played by Fred Hechinger. General Acacius, who's played by Pedro Pascal, wins glory for them by conquering far-off lands, including, as the film opens, the city in which the mysterious Hanno, played by Paul Mescal, lives. Enslaved following the sacking of Numidia, the city, Hanno is brought to Rome to participate in the gladiatorial games. He is owned by a power behind the throne named Macrinus, who's played by Denzel Washington. He uses his wealth and his mastery of secrets in the city to accrue more and more power to himself. General Acacius is married to Marcus Aurelius's daughter, Lucilla, played once again by Connie Nielsen. She hopes still to return Rome to a republic and regrets having sent her son, Lucius, away to keep him safe from assassins in Rome. And you'll never guess who the mysterious Hanno turns out to be or who his father really is. Or maybe it's weirdly and annoyingly obvious almost from the beginning. It's annoying. I say it's annoying because there's really no reason for all of this familial bloodline stuff to be in here in the first place. And this is kind of my biggest issue with Gladiator 2, is that the folks involved with making this movie have badly miscalibrated why the first one is so beloved. Like, the original film is a fairly straightforward revenge movie. It's just a revenge movie that's gussied up by some classy ideals about, you know, the people and democracy and justice and the Republic, et cetera, et cetera. But it's a revenge movie. It is a big, bloody revenge movie. And the sequel, meanwhile, seems to think that the main reason everybody loved the first was all the stuff about the restoration of the Roman Republic. Gotta have the restoration of the Republic. We need it. That's why we came to this movie. That's why it's beloved. The revenge huge portion of Gladiator 2 is hopelessly muddled. It's just, it is hopelessly muddled. So I want to just, there's like, here's the flow chart for you. Hanno slash Lucius wants to take revenge against Acacius, who led the army that killed his wife in combat, but then he forgives Acacius, but then he has to take vengeance against Macrinus, who kills his mother. And Macrinus also kills both of the emperors who had ordered his mother's death. And that's where the revenge is actually Lucius versus Macrinus. I'm sorry, this flowchart nature of it is ridiculous. And I don't mean to harp on this, but the original is, again, it's very, very simple. And its brilliance is the simplicity. Commodus had Maximus's innocent wife and son killed. Therefore, Maximus needs revenge against Commodus. That's it. That's the movie right there. The filmmakers also seem to have fundamentally misunderstood the appeal of Russell Crowe in the original. Paul Mescal may be a fine actor. I've always been a little bit flummoxed by all of the praise he gets, for example, in Aftersun, which is fine. But he is not a movie star, at least in the traditional masculine action star sense, right? The guy, to use a phrase from Twitter, he doesn't have the juice. I'm sorry. I don't know if it's the pitch of his voice or his like kind of droopy eyes or whatever. The guy just doesn't have it, right? Crow felt like a weary general with kind of a spark of humor behind his eyes who commanded the loyalty of his troops. Mescal feels like a tired and kind of angry teenager. He plays the role like a teenager. Washington is good, though he's basically just redoing Training Day. Pascal is actually probably closer to what the film needs in a Maximus replacement figure, but he's too old for the part. Quinn and Hechinger are amusingly deranged, but kind of too silly to take it seriously. The action scenes are big, but weirdly inert. Having just rewatched the original, actually, I was kind of torn because on the one hand, the action in the sequel is more visually coherent. It's less choppy. There's like, it's steadier, I guess. On the other, though, I really miss the chaos and the choppiness of the original, right? Big bloody action sequences should be a little chaotic, a little incoherent. It all felt just a little too clean in the sequel. Peter, was I just expecting, were my hopes too high? Was I expecting too much from a legacy sequel a quarter century in the making? Or am I right to be a little put off by all this?
No, you were not expecting too much because the original is really pretty great. And Ridley Scott is, you know, the creator of the original, the director of the original, and as the director of this one. The problem is that Ridley Scott is, on the one hand, one of the most competent craftsmen in filmmaking and has been for 40-something years. He's also one of the least consistent directors in Hollywood. He has made a handful of, like, stone-cold masterpieces. Alien, Blade Runner, Gladiator. The Last Duel is truly excellent. And I even think stuff like The Martian is not a stone-cold classic, but it's just really well-done popular filmmaking. And then he also makes stuff like the Gucci film that just was like, this isn't terrible. It's, in fact, looks kind of great, but it's not a very good movie. And he consistently, like, this is his consistent thing, is that he's incredibly inconsistent. His movies always look great. They always have just enough of an idea behind them that you can't totally dismiss them. But a lot of them don't come together as complete and coherent, not just films, but like as like ideas about the story and or sort of a worldview here, right? And this is the thing I think the movie really struggles with, is that on the one hand, it wants to be a straightforward action, you know, historical action thriller, just a revenge film. And on the other hand, Ridley Scott kind of wants this to have something to say about Rome, but maybe about the present, about the great men of history and how awful they are and how politics is just, you know, this sort of power struggle. I mean, you can, you know, last year he did Napoleon. And a big part of what Napoleon was a takedown of Napoleon as great man of history. It was really this sort of revisionist look at him as a sort of, frankly, a little shit. Because he sought power and he didn't care like at all what happened to the little people in the world as long as he got his power. And there is something to that idea creeps into Gladiator 2, but not in a way that's fully developed or fully coherent. And a big part of the problem is that like to the extent that Denzel Washington's character, Macrinus, is the avatar of that idea, it's
pretty interesting just because Denzel Washington is always interesting. He can take basically anything that's on a page, and you're just like, at least I, but I think you too as well. So, oh, so happy to just hear him speak words, like any set of words, random nonsense. I am just happy to listen to him speak dialogue on screen. Where, and so it makes some of the stuff that he's saying a little more powerful and a little more coherent, but then he's pitted against Paul Mescal as like the idea of a better Rome guy, and Paul Mescal, you're right, it's, he just doesn't have it, and he can't take the total generalities that he's given to speak here, that like, that don't really add up to anything. He can't make his character make sense, and he can't make his character's worldview make sense. So you have this clash of worldviews in which it's not actually very clear or strongly depicted on the page, but one of the actors is so powerful that he makes it strong, and then the other one just is not there. So you have the, it's an odd mashup. It's an odd movie. I don't think it fully works. It's beautiful at times, and Denzel Washington is fun to watch.
Yeah. Well, and Peter, you know, you were talking about how, you know, this is supposed to be a movie to a certain extent like Napoleon, where the problem is that the leaders don't care about the little people, but the Roman people just don't exist in this movie in any way, right? There's no character who's not, you know, either a, you know, someone who lives outside the empire, lives inside a gladiatorial ring, or lives in these incredibly rarefied sort of court and senatorial circles. And so there is no Roman people. And the Roman people that we see are entirely, you know, sort of slaves themselves to the narrative of the Colosseum, right? I mean, we see their whims sort of go back and forth. They riot when, you know, things sort of go wrong. But there is no sense of the Roman people or of like a people who could, you know, deserve or be worthy of or embody or have questions about or push back against this sort of dream of Rome, right? And, you know, there is a very interesting sort of assimilationist idea in Rome, the idea that Rome was sort of, you know, a syncretic empire, right? That it, you know, conquered large parts of the world, but, you know, managed to allow people to become Roman while retaining sort of some other parts of their culture and personality. And it's a remarkably sort of incurious movie. I found it so forgettable. I have to say it just sort of like passed through my brain.
It's so boring.
Yeah.
It really, I hate to say movies are boring, but this just, I was like, get to the,
Yeah. It feels very long. And, you know, Peter, you and I were sort of texting about this before the show, and, you know, you sort of said Denzel Washington was great. And it's like, I think Denzel Washington is enjoying himself in this movie, but I don't know that I think this is a great performance. You know, it's a lot of performance. It is a large quantity of performance.
So I'll defend greatness just real quick, just a little bit. Like what you responded to me was he's enjoying himself and that's enjoyable. And I agree. I think what's great about this is that you can see how good he is in an incredibly underwritten role in a movie with a kind of trash script. He's the only person who is truly interesting to watch and who's it truly interesting to listen to in this film. Everybody else takes the lines that they're given and they read them dutifully in this very, you know, mannered screen actor way of just of like not overdoing it, of kind of giving everything this sort of same glum Ridley Scott seriousness treatment. And Denzel Washington is not just having fun. He is seeking to entertain you. And I am entertained. Am I not entertained? I am entertained. And there's a greatness to that, to both be willing to do it and to be capable of doing it. And I think, I think a lot of actors aren't willing. And like just he just goes for it. Again, it's like our Cormac McCarthy correspondent.
Yeah. I mean, I think there's something to be said for going for it, but it, you know, there's only so much that can be done with this movie. I will say there is something interesting and sort of coincidental about this movie's argument that it's a sort of nonpartisan military that can end factional strife. It's interesting to have someone making that argument on the big screen at a moment of you know, sort of a new administration is coming in. There's a question about whether the military itself will be sort of polarized after an election, where there was some question about, you know, what former people who had served in the military under Donald Trump in his first term had sort of come out and said about him after they left the military. I do think we're in a kind of interesting moment in terms of how people think about the military and about civic life. And I wish that Gladiator 2 had sort of rhymed with that in a more forceful and interesting way. Because there is an argument to be made there, maybe not necessarily a convincing one, but there are ideas that are worth exploring.
Now, part of that is just the timeline on production here. This movie went into production in early 23.
It's entirely coincidental, yeah. But the movie itself does not have ideas about,
I agree with that,
sort of the military as an institution. It just sort of asserts that it is capable of playing this role without examining sort of why that might be possible or what it would mean for a republic to be backed by sort of military rather than anything else.
Interestingly, the first Gladiator actually gets into this more. There's a scene with Gracchus or one of the senators where Maximus is like, if my legions learn I am alive, they will rally to my cause and we can march on the city and we will rid you of this Commodus. And the senator's like, why would I trade one unelected ruler for another? What good does that get me? And here it's just like, okay, let's do it. I don't know, sure. Why not?
Yeah, there's no engagement with that.
Yeah. There's also always this weird, we see this in Megalopolis a little bit too. There's this weird compulsion to like kind of be like, what if America's kind of like Rome? And like, I don't know how much Roman history y'all have read, but like the comparisons don't really work in terms of the actual civic structures of like the Roman Senate is not the same thing as the United States Senate in America. Like it just is not, that's not, they're not really equivalent in any serious way. I don't know.
I heard men think about Rome a lot.
Every day. Once a day.
I do kind of wonder if I'm the person on this podcast who thinks about Rome the most. I think that's possible.
Entirely possible.
I will say, even though I do not recommend Gladiator 2, Mary Beard's new book, The Emperor of Rome, about sort of the institution of the emperor in the Roman Empire is very good, as is everything Mary Beard writes. And so I would highly recommend that instead of going to see Gladiator 2.
Yeah. No, I just want to say on the question of Denzel Washington, I do feel like he, Hechinger, and Quinn are in an entirely different movie from everybody else in this movie. Like they are in one movie that's actually kind of interesting, and I would probably watch 2.5 hours of that. And then everybody else is in an entirely different, more serious feeling movie that is just kind of boring and dull and full of itself.
I think the better movie, the better version of this would have basically skipped or at least heavily downplayed Paul Mescal's Lucius entirely, done away with a connection to the first film, and actually just focused on Macrinus and told his story and allowed us to see this kind of twisted alternative version of somebody rising up through gladiatordom.
Yeah.
Macrinus and Acacius.
Macrinus.
Yeah.
Whatever. I mean, whatever. I wasn't trying to correct your pronunciation. I may be pronouncing it wrong.
Yeah, no, I think that would have been much, much more interesting. And Pedro Pascal is like not bad in this. I do not think Connie Nielsen is good in this at all.
Again, she's just not given much to do and she doesn't do anything with it. Pascal's good. Again, Pascal gives off the Russell Crowe vibes kind of that this movie needed from that character. But he's just like they just didn't want another movie about a Roman general, you know, leading a revolt against the emperors.
Well, they both wanted another movie about a Roman that's kind of the same, except not quite the same movie. And it's both too much the same and also not the same enough.
Yeah. It's like they made the same movie, but they got all the ingredients totally wrong. It's like, we're going to make this cake, but instead of using sugar, we're going to use like sea salt. Like, no. That's
chickpea flour.
Oh, don't do that. All right. So what do we think? Thumbs up or thumbs down on Gladiator 2? Alyssa?
Thumbs down.
Peter?
A thumbs down, but I don't think it's as boring as you said, Sonny. And I think that if you're a Gladiator fan, it's not worth seeing. It's just not good.
Thumbs down. If you're a Gladiator fan, avoid this movie. It's bad. It desecrates the corpse of the original. Stick with the Gladiator number one. Watch that on 4K instead. All right. That's it for today's show. Many thanks to our producer, Sebastian Hughes, without whom this program would sound much worse. Make sure to swing by Bulwark Plus on Friday for our bonus episode. Tell your friends. Strong recommendation from a friend is basically the only way to grow podcast audiences. If we don't grow, we'll die. If you did not love today's episode, please complain to me on Twitter at SunnyBunch. I'll convince you that this is, in fact, the best show in your podcast feed. See you guys on Friday.